How are you? I welcome you with all my heart. Today, I've gotten some interesting posts, either on Facebook or on the blog. One of which recently was about various points of view. I was dialoguing with a Zen teacher or a Buddhist teacher from the Middle Path, and he was talking about the essence of people or persons being this brilliant, clear emptiness. And I said, no, it's not. And so we dialogued back and forth about Nisargadatta and his notion of self-realization, Ramana, his notion of self-realization, and this guy who was talking about no self. And I said, you know, Buddhists don't have a concept of self. They're not going to find a self. Even if you slap them in the face with a self, they're not going to find a self. The enlightenment for a Buddhist is not of a self. Also, the self that's talked about in traditional Advaita is a lot different than Nisargadatta talks about, and a lot different from what Ramana talks about. From Ramana, self is consciousness, Satchitananda, existence, knowledge, bliss. For Nisargadatta, it's going beyond consciousness, going to the witness, going to the absolute subject and dwelling there, not even aware of being aware. And for the Buddhists, it's emptiness. They have 8 stages of emptiness depending upon the school that you belong to. And the thing is, you can have hundreds of monks in each school, and each one will experience what they're taught to experience. The concepts color what they see, feel, hear, and touch. Each one experiences emptiness in a different way. And somebody said, well, there must be a common element. What's the common denominator from all of these teachings? What's the common experience with all of these teachings? There ain't any. What's enlightenment for one is nothing to another school. Nothing valuable or something to be transcended. The Buddhists find no self and just get snuffed out in nirvana. The self gets snuffed out, and they keep living as a robot in peace. Well, spontaneously, whatever actions come up for them comes up. But thinking doesn't intrude, supposedly, into how they live their lives, which is bullshit. There's a difference between theory and monks in real life. Then there's the self-realization of Ramana, which is just to reveal to yourself that you are both the inner and empty, inner and outer phenomena. You are consciousness and everything within consciousness. Nisargadatta says that's a lower form of enlightenment. A higher form is to be snuffed out altogether, but not in the way of the Buddhists, which see emptiness as that which snuffs out. There are many different schools, and each one has a different end. Never forget that. So many people in spirituality think they must all have the same understanding. That's not true at all. Consciousness is so vast, so deep, the mind so mischievous, the senses so unstable, that what is one man's truth is another man's falseness. The Advaitins classical don't believe in what the Buddhists talk about. The Buddhists, for most part, don't believe in what the Zen people talk about or what they experience in Satoris. Ditto Ramana. Ditto Nisargadatta. consciousness is so great, so deep, so powerful, so energetic, that it could have 100,000 saints, each spending an entire lifetime exploring one tiny aspect of it, each becoming a master of one particular aspect of it, and in the end, they share nothing in common. Sufi path is a Sufi path. It's filled with all kinds of phenomena, emptinesses, fullnesses, God, energies, healing, black energies, witches, witchcraft, warlocks. It's a very rich tradition, alchemy. Zen is only form is emptiness, emptiness is form. Feeling, thought, and consciousness are also like this. These are men of action, not men of contemplation. The Zen people are very active, very much into the moment, whether the moment is of warfare, or fucking, or eating, or doing some work around the house. Just what's happening at the moment. Very simple. No mind. Just response immediately, infinitely quickly. And then we have Ramana sitting on his bed, 18 hours a day, open to visitors while he reads the newspaper or talks with them individually, but giving no big talks like this. People just come to him one by one when they have some problem, and they talk to him. The talks are recorded. His realization was when he was pretending to be dead that he was still alive. And just that life force itself is God and is him. That's the message he developed after 30 years of sitting, resting in consciousness, the I am, the I am, the I am. Nisargadatta started out that way, as a devotee of his guru. Found God consciousness, found Krishna consciousness, and then gradually dried up and became a jnani, having gone all the way beyond consciousness to a different level of existence or non-existence, that of the witness. You might say that he found a singularity, to use the scientist terms, within all of the phenomena that make up the world in the inner life. The witness, the absolute, that which sees the phenomena, or that which knows the phenomena. And he called the phenomena itself as knowing. So the knower was that which knew consciousness with all of its different manifestations. So don't think that you're ever going to penetrate to the end of consciousness, for there is no end. Maybe there is, but you'd have to circle consciousness three or four times, like circling the universe. It takes a bit of time. There's no one who's mastered all traditions, even though many claim that their teacher has mastered everything. Sansanim used to go to Muktananda satsangs, where they'd have chanting and he'd be laughing and telling stories. And Sansanim from the back of the auditorium would hit the floor and make this scream at the same time, "Cucks!" Everybody thought he was nuts. And he probably was. Why in hell would a Zen master go to a Kundalini yoga and love guru and yell "Cucks," which is supposedly cut the thinking, except to get into Dharma combat with Muktananda? Well, Sansanim was ushered out. And as he was leaving, Muktananda said, "Nuts." Yet Sansanim is probably the epitome of a certain kind of Zen teacher. A master's master in many ways. In Korea, he's highly looked upon because of his ability to tell people what the truth is according to Zen. But the only truth is, there is no truth. The truth of one tradition is the falsity of another tradition. So I'd say right up front, what I teach is self-realization. The recognition that comes to you like a punch in the face that immediately grabs your attention and holds it forever. You know who you are, Matthew. You know who you are, Dinesh. You know who you are, Newton and Max and Keith. Instead of wondering, who am I? The answer comes in a way that's not verbalized. It comes in a way when you feel your whole beingness, every grain in your body, every corpuscle in your energy body. You feel all the energies racing through your sense of presence, and yet you feel the divine at the same time. This is self-realization. Recognition of who you are as sentience, not who you are as the body, but who you are as sentience, who you are as that functioning of knowing in the human being. I know my foot. I know my body. I know my energy sense. This is all a recognition. I recognize who I am. I am all of this. I am all of these phenomena. They are me. I. The I is strongly present and manifesting as a living presence within you and around you everywhere. And part of that sentience is projecting outwards into the world all of these images and thoughts which sort of construct the world around us. Gradually you learn that that is you too, because without your beingness it wouldn't exist, because all of that exists because of your beingness and within your beingness. So without you, none of that exists. At least for you, it doesn't. It may exist for others, but you know the secret. You know the real secret. Nobody sees matter the way it really is. We see light given off by electrons, and our brain makes up images and creates a space around us filled with objects. And those are conditioned by the way we were brought up to be chairs and couches and cars. But nobody sees the thing in itself. We can't. We see a representation built by the mind, built by consciousness. So the real world we never see. We see a functional equivalent which allows this body and this sense of presence to make its way through the world. But we don't know what it's really like. We only know what we know. And what we know is conditioned by who we are, how we're brought up, our crappy educations and public school systems, where they train you for 12 years to be a prisoner and to be subservient and not question and just soak up all this knowledge and all this bullshit, which is always bullshit. How many history classes have you taken in the United States where they've told you about the Indian massacres foisted upon them by us, the winning side? Are the Russians ever a good guy in any of our history books? Is Nazi Germany ever a homey place to visit on weekends? Or is it always evil? Aren't we getting a daily dose of this every day on television and in the media? The evil ones out there over and over and over again. Who's the bad guy? All the media get behind whoever's the bad guy of the moment. Whoever they want you to feel is bad. So, you can never reach the end of searching. What you can do is reach the end of your searching, where finally you know who you are. I think some of the other paths have no end. And even after self-realization in my path, they're still continuing to flower and to open. So if you're confused as to who you are and where you are, join 99% of the human race. Join 99.99% of the human race. And even the most grounded Zen master at times has doubts. Even somebody that's practiced 30 or 40 years, situations still arise where they don't know what to do or how to handle it. But self-realization brings a kind of consciousness of who you are. It doesn't make you necessarily a better decider, but you're a more quick decider. You don't go through three encyclopedias of books before you make a decision. You're not a friggin' librarian going through the Dewey Decimal System, checking all of the knowledge before you make a decision. Your decision is instantaneous and based on an intuition, an inner intuition that wells up within you because you feel inside of you, you feel the energy, you feel the light of consciousness at all times. And you also feel how that's connected with space around you and also how that's connected with the external world. And your reactions are swift and to the point and generally quite accurate. And when they're not, so what? I can fuck up once or twice a day and not care. If I do it 30 or 40 times a day, I might doubt myself, but once or twice is, nah. But that's what I teach, is self-realization. Not going beyond the universe into some place that has no existence and cannot be seen, like Nisargadatta's final enlightenment of the witness. You'll find the witness soon enough when you die. In the meantime, explore life. Explore the energy. Mostly explore love. That's my message. Explore love. I'm not really a bhakti guru because I came from such a heady past. It's really hard to make that complete leap into 100%, 1,000,000% devotion in all things. I still hold on to the idea that knowledge can set the mind at ease and allow easier for love to flow. For love can truly transform. Knowledge only rests the mind, and when the mind is rested, it can act from a place of peace, from a heart that's at rest and feeling the world from the heart. But love, total love, can transform, and I don't mean a little bitty, itty, bitty, bitty love. I mean big love, insane love, nutty love, jump over the cliff love, total heartful love. And you can get this by doing a little bit at a time. Loving your mother while she's alive. Loving your father while he's alive. Loving your girlfriend or boyfriend or was husband or wife. Or be open to love coming from outside. Love a cat. And we've got lots of them around here. Come on over. I'll give you one to love. While you're here, you can adopt it for a half an hour or a day. But love, 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 love. Love, 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 love. I'm going to have chanting now, and the next topic is going to be on the guru and on the different faces of them. Just as knowledge and experiences in the spiritual world are infinite in number and infinite in depth, so too are the finite expressions found in various teachers. The greatest number of teachers today are, what would you call it, self-taught. They read a lot of books and discover or think they should be teaching. They give seminars, which can be highly intellectual. Their talks are more about meditation rather than showing you how to do it. Their talks are about love, not showing you how to do it. Their talks are about the energies, but they don't impart them to you directly. They're book learners. or some who have had some experiences and decide all too soon to become teachers. The generation I studied with, the masters that came over here in the 60s and 70s, from Sasaki Roshi to Thich Thien Hanh, who was equivalent of a bishop in the Zen Church of Vietnam, to Maizumi, who was a seventh generation Zen master in his family, to Sansanim, who even now at 105 is getting into the newspapers for being irascible, to Robert, who spent 50 years teaching all over the world, 17 years in India, going to various teachers after his realization. They have an infinite number of personalities that manifest. Some are quiet, like Robert, and stare ahead in a fixed kind of way. Some are noisy, like Sansanim, who when he was talking on the phone, got so loud and screaming at the top of his voice, he could be heard in Korea directly. No phone was necessary. He was always screaming at somebody. Muktananda was like that too. In a public performance, he'd be sweet like I am right now, and like I always am. But then, to the people who knew him closely, he was a firebrand. He burnt people's asses all the time over the slightest trivial thing. People felt like walking on eggshells around him. When is that monster going to go off? And they loved him, despite the fact he was a firebomb. Some of them even used to drink his urine. It was the guru's urine. They wanted to be like him. They wanted to be close to him because of his energy, because of their belief and trust in him, their love for him. They loved him completely. But he burned them constantly. Robert did the same thing too. He was Mr. Chaos. Robert would give the same test to four or five different people, not telling any one of them that anybody else is doing it. Robert would talk behind your back, saying, "He doesn't understand anything." And to your face, he'd say, "Congratulations." And to somebody else who said to him, "He's doing well, isn't he?" Robert would say, "Not so much." You never knew who the center of all this chaos was, except you knew it was Robert. He once came to me and said, "Ed, I need $7,000, or I needed $10,000. And he says, "My wife makes clothes and sells them at swap meets and other places. I'll give you a share of the business for $10,000. Well, I had only known Robert for maybe 8 or 9 months. And I could scare up $7,000. I was rich then. He took that away later. But I scared up $7,000 and gave it to him. I never heard about his wife's business or any other business ever since. That loan was a gift, big donation, and I knew it when I gave it. He was a hustler. He would undermine you every chance he got, build you up at other times, and always skin you alive by gossiping about you, or saying something that shocked you, or saying something that shocked somebody else's sensibility. He wasn't very politically correct. Or he'd take people to see a movie like was that Natural Born Killers with the guy from Cheers, where they go through the movie slaughtering people? Or like Tianan, my teacher at the Zendo, who used to make soup on the weekends for our joint get-togethers, the sanghas, where we clean the satsang for 2 hours on the weekends. He put hot pepper in the soup and cayenne powder, and when people ate it, their eyes would water, their nose would water, their sinuses would water for 20 minutes or 30 minutes. One day, much to everybody's dismay, he put a chicken in the soup. Everybody was a vegetarian. Were they shocked to find out that they had eaten chicken soup? You stir the pot, stir the pot, stir the pot. Michael, who is my protege here, Michael found this book about Neem Karoli Baba. What is his name?
Neem Karoli Baba.
Neem Karoli Baba. And when I heard this, when I read this, such glee came to my face. Listen to this. Wherever Maharaji was, there was chaos and confusion. Sometimes two people were sent to do the same task. Other times one was sent to undo what the first was in the process of doing. Maharaji would tell one person one thing and another something opposite. When confronted with such inconsistencies, he would deny it all. And so did Robert. He denied what? What? I didn't say that. I didn't say that. Right in front of the people he said it to, he said, I didn't say that. Such confusion served a number of obvious purposes. First, it veiled his powers so that no one could be quite certain what had just happened. And the confusion also allowed each person to hear what he or she needed to hear from among the conflicting bits of information. Such inconsistencies served to loosen the minds of those devotees with problems of rigid thinking. And so many people in our Sangha in the past have had rigid thinking about what a guru is like, what a student is like, what the proper roles are, what the proper attitude is, proper behaviors especially, and they run. And they ran from Robert too. From another point of view, one could understand the confusion as a reflection of the fact that Maharaji was not just one person. As a mirror, he was the reflection of whomever was thinking upon him, and he was conscious on many planes at once. Thus, one statement such as, I can do nothing, might be followed moments later by the statement, I hold the keys to the mind. Everyone is my puppet. Appreciating this dimension of Maharaji made one delight in the confusion. Now, I told you I didn't think much of Muktananda. I spent a lot of time around him. But Shankarananda told me that he had never in his entire life seen anyone as surrendered as Muktananda. He said somebody would come up to him and start getting close to him with their ideas and their purposes and their problems. And Muktananda would just sort of retreat from all the noise coming from that person. And then an hour later, somebody else would come from a different direction, completely opposite, about different noises. And Muktananda would be blown away and agree with that person at that particular moment. But it was like he was extremely sensitive to the winds and whoever it was right in front of him, and would make a decision at that moment in that person's favor and a minute later in somebody else's favor. That's part of it too. It's not wishy-washiness so much as kind of a guru response to the situation at hand. Robert would be the same way, but he'd be more silent when he'd listen to people talk. Then he'd make a decision and do his manipulation behind your back. There's another paragraph here. Before he left in 95, for 6 months prior to that, he was saying that there was going to be a great earthquake on San Andreas Fault, and people should get out of town and move with him to Sedona. And he would talk about the great earthquake coming every third or fourth satsang. And I believed him. That was in the days before I realized what gurus were doing. And I wrote to the press saying, the papers in town, predicting an earthquake in September or October, whenever he said it was. And I did it with lots of letters to lots of editors. The earthquake never happened. I had an egg on my face for a long period of time. But Robert did a lot of predictions. But listen to this. This is, again, Neem Karola Bhava. Maharaji would make predictions or say something of a personal import in an offhand manner in the middle of a political discussion. Often his predictions wouldn't come true. If you wanted a specific prediction from Maharaji, he would often be vague and he'd never give an explanation for his predictions. Now, I was driving Robert to Sedona, and we were in Palmdale, I believe it was. And out of the, he was in the seat next to me, and he said, "This is where it's going to be." And I said, "What?" He said, "The great earthquake. This is where it is." And he said it with such certainty, it redoubled my belief, and it never happened. He cooked me big time. So, most people want a guru that's predictable. Robert was not predictable. Neem Karola Bhava was not predictable. Muktananda was not predictable. Most people want a guru of peace and love and harmony. Muktananda was screaming at people all the time. Sansanim was screaming at people all the time in Korean and English. Robert never screamed at anybody. He just talked behind your back. So there are different kinds of ways of gurus doing things. But the biggest ones, the ones that I know of that were the most famous, were screamers. They still had a big will behind them, like Sansanim, who actually recreated Zen in the United States because he had this passion and this energy that drove him at 600 miles per hour all the time. Muktananda too, he died very early, 78 I think he was, or 78 years old. But he had this energy, a palpable energy. If you went into satsang, you would feel his energy. It would vibrate everywhere, especially once the chanting started. And yet, everybody was saying, "Is this teacher enlightened because he's like this? Is that teacher enlightened because he's like this?" I've known many, many students that came to Robert, that came to Muktananda. And they tried to manipulate the teacher. Sometimes they did it with money, by promising money, like the people did to go to Sedona. And Robert went to Sedona and told me at the same time they were never going to keep their obligations, yet he went anyway. Certain people have tried to seduce me into becoming a Hollywood guru and going to Hollywood kinds of functions and ways of doing things. I remember for one satsang, one of the people wanted to get $700 in donation for food that night, even though 35 people were going to show up. I just didn't get it. It just didn't compute. Well, they left because they could find another guru who wanted to be a Hollywood guru and set up a satsang and sangha in Los Angeles. I'm not going to fool you guys. Like I say, I'm always honest. If you're an asshole, I'll tell you you're an asshole. I'm an asshole. I'll tell you I'm an asshole. It's really not good to get in a rut when you have a spiritual practice. If there is no chaos, you tend to get in a rut. You can practice meditation 8 hours a day and have no internal conflict or external conflict. I remember when I was at Mount Baldy and it was snowing all the time. They'd get the men up at 3 o'clock in the morning to go shovel the snow off of the paths at the Zendo, around the Zendo, and throughout the the 7 acres. I got up at 2:45 when it was snowing, went to the Zendo, and started sitting meditation. They thought I was such a great monk potential because I was always meditating. I was up there before Roshi turned his lights on. So they never bothered me. I manipulated the system. Nobody else figured that manipulation. They were up at 3 o'clock in the morning shoveling the sidewalks. I only had to spend an extra 30 minutes in meditation, and I skipped all of that. And not only that, I got brownie points for being strong in my sitting. I remember one time Ryoshu, who was there's always one monk that's in charge of running the Zendo when the Roshi isn't there. He's called Jikijitsu. Jikijitsu would go around with a stick in his hand, and he'd get in front of somebody that's beginning to go to sleep like this, and he'd bow, and hopefully you could had enough presence to see him and bow to him, and then he'd hit you on the shoulder twice. And sometimes they hit hard. Everybody got to be a Jikijitsu. But one time Ryoshu was going around because people weren't getting off of their tons quickly enough to see Roshi and to talk to Roshi and go to Sanzen to create chaos. And he'd rip people off in the sitting position and throw them out and tell them to go and go and go and go. And got them running, and it was so there would be chaos. Till he got to me, and he tried to pull me off, but I wouldn't let him. I pulled him towards me, because I was about 50 pounds heavier than he was. And then I finally got up, and we were doing randori on the Zendo floor, trying to throw each other judo style. And he just said, "You strong," and left and walked away. It's chaos. The need for chaos. In order to not allow one to get fixed, not allow one to get politically correct, not to allow one to think you must be soft and vulnerable and loving every minute of the day, sometimes you got to get hard and kick ass. Go with the flow. Don't always be politically correct. Don't always be the nice guy. Don't always never use the word shit or fuck. Use them frequently just to make a point that you don't have to be this nice guy. You can be a bad guy once in a while. One time I was with one of my Zen teachers, Kozan. Kozan was the dumbest Zen teacher I ever knew. He used to say, most people think there are only 1,700 koans. He says, no, there are 25,000. He said, I learned them all. If I can learn them, anybody can learn them. So while we were sitting there and he was giving a talk, and this was during the summer, he reached down and crushed an ant with his thumb. And then he laughed. He says, you probably think that's a terrible thing to do, that the Zen master shouldn't do that. So then he reached down and crushed three more, 1, 2, 3, right after that, to show us not to get in a groove of being a peacenik, not to just be passive, not just to be life-affirming, but to sometimes you got to be a prick. And he was showing us in the gentlest possible way to be a prick. Kozan used to be afraid of high heights. So he used to train himself to be not afraid of high heights. He put a plank over a deep well that was over 100 feet deep and climbed out on the plank and sat there in Zazen day after day until his teachers told him not to do that anymore. He was being foolish. Always the unexpected. Always chaos. And that's why there was another teacher, who was it? Meher Baba. There was a guy in the ashram who was always causing trouble. Everybody hated him. He was always noisy, getting into trouble, making things hard, being meddling, and so forth. And everybody hated him. So finally, one day, this guy went away. And Mayor Baba sent one of his inner people after the guy and said, come back to the ashram. And he paid him to stay at the ashram, to continue to create chaos. But the people here, they want me to be sweet. They want me to be a nice guy all the time. They don't want to see me crushing ants with my thumb. They want me to tell them how wonderful they are and what great progress they've made. That I don't see anything wrong with them in any way, shape, or form. They should just continue to do what they're doing in their so politically correct way. Always being sweet and loving and providing a loving space for everybody around them. And when I don't, they run. Like Samantha and Marcus. They run to Rajiv, a teacher that's always quiet, that's always politically correct, that's always smiling. And they put hearts after their conversations to each other. Rajiv would put heart, heart, heart after one of his students put heart, heart, and then he'd heart, heart each other, fill up the page with hearts. I love you, Rajiv. I love you too, Samantha. I love you too, Marcus. I love you all so much from the bottom of my heart. Heart, 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 heart. I'm politically correct. I say nothing bad. I'm silent about everything. You can tell me any secret you want. It'll never go beyond my lips, my ears. I'm a great secret teller. And they don't tell anybody secrets. They just let them pile up inside until one day you explode with all the secrets in you. Some of my teachers, students have come to me with all kinds of secrets that were destroying them because another guru told them to keep it secret. And I can't keep it secret, it's destroying me. One by one, the secrets would come out and they felt better. So I am a teacher of big mouth Zen, you might say. Vent. Say what's on your mind. Say what's on your heart. You know, let it all out. Don't hold back.